Hi there. My name is Clifford Machingaifa, associate producer with the African Tech Roundup. This show is brought to you in association with our friends over at Business Live and Multimedia Live. Thanks to them, you can now listen to this episode on businesslive.co.za and wherever you stream Multimedia Live podcasts. In this episode, we take a look at agritech startup Binkabi through the eyes of their CEO, Quan Lei, and learn why he believes that blockchain is set to revolutionize commodity trading in emerging markets. We also get to hear a little bit about Andile's second favorite city in the world. We're excited to be a part of Afrobytes again in 2020, happening in Paris on the 9th of June at Station F. We're really hoping to meet you there as we have the world's most diverse innovation ecosystem all under one roof.
So my name is Quan Lei and I'm the founder and CEO of Binkabi, which is a platform for issuing, trading and financing commodities on the blockchain. We focus on Africa and agriculture supply chain.
Welcome to the African Tech Roundup, Quan Lei.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. Now, I had the pleasure of being in your country several months ago. Ho Chi Minh City currently stands as my second favorite Asian city.
Okay, so the favorite one must be Hanoi, where I'm from.
No, it's not.
The most.
I'm sorry. I love the frantic energy of Ho Chi Minh City, and my favorite city in Asia is actually Kuala Lumpur. But
okay, cool. So we have some way to go.
You have some way to go. Fine. But I mean, by way of sort of introducing yourself, you've already told us you're from Hanoi. I'm sorry that Hanoi comes in at maybe 4 or 5 on my list.
Okay, we're among the top five.
You are in the top five.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, but give our listeners a sense of where you're coming from with this. I mean, we're going to talk about your professional credentials. A squiz at your bio gives me a sense of where the DNA for the idea that you're currently backing might have come from. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Talk to me about Quan from Hanoi.
Sure. Okay. So you've been to Vietnam. Hopefully you have a bit of a chance to travel up and down the country. You might think that Ho Chi Minh City is the coolest place in Vietnam. However, the majority of the population is actually live in the countryside. And Vietnam has as a country, it's very long from Hanoi to Ho Chi Minh City. It's about 2,000 kilometers apart.
Yeah.
And there are many, many provinces and cities along the coastline. And a lot of the population is actually engaged in agriculture. So in Vietnam, you can see that there's an abundance of agriculture produce. You can eat rice. You can eat many type of good food, fish, chicken, vegetable. However, it has not always been the case. Vietnam only becomes one of the largest exporter of agricultural commodities in the last 10 to 20 years. Before that, Vietnam is actually a major importer of, you know, staple food like rice and proteins. So back in the days when I was growing up in Vietnam, I still remember my father used to have to skip 1 or 2 days from work every month in order to queue up to buy food from the ration that the state gave us. And back in the days, it was a luxury for us to be able to eat rice just by itself and with a white color, because we often didn't have enough and we often have to eat rice in combination with other kind of starchy root crops like cassava or potatoes or sweet potatoes and so on. Very, very low quality. So Vietnam is an example of a transformation from a net food importer to the net food exporter. So today, Vietnam as a sector, as a country, export about $30 billion worth of food. Whereas if you look at the case of Africa, as a whole, Africa imports about $40 billion. So how can actually a country move from a net importer to net exporter? So the way we see it is Vietnam has gone through a transformation, which hopefully is happening in Africa right now. So Africa is what Vietnam was 25 years ago.
And it's crazy when you just compare the size of our entire continent and its sort of collective output in agriculture relative to really the minuscule size by comparison of Vietnam. And I'm going to want us to talk about you know, some of your learnings around this, but explain how a bean counter goes from that to founding a blockchain tech company, because you're a chartered accountant. Yeah. And
I mean, it seems
improbable.
Yeah. Yes, I'm probably too creative for a bean counter. So I probably wouldn't have been doing very well if I would still continue to be an accountant, which I started to be back in 1990s. So I started as a auditor working for a big company called PwC, which has many people and many offices around the world. Because back in those days, when Vietnam just opened up, and we are just graduated from universities, actually working for a foreign company, the structure of PwC is a cool thing to do. So we didn't have a lot of more, let's say, sexy opportunities. That's why we, myself included, applied to work for PwC as an auditor. And then I actually spent not so much time in auditing, but actually focusing on advisory and strategy. So from auditing, I moved to merger acquisition advisory, and then ultimately to strategy, which is mainly working with the financial sectors. So I used to work with banks all over the world, but focus more on emerging markets. Including those in Africa. So the journey there took about 16 years when I started in the mid-1990s to about 2011. And from 2011, I started a company that focuses on bringing technology in agriculture from Vietnam, but also from other places, to actually make some changes in food production in Africa. So for the last 7 years, we have been involved in over 30 projects, working on 100,000 hectares of land, helping Africa to grow some of the most sought-after staple food, like food like rice, cassava, fish, tomatoes. These are also the commodities that Africa has been importing in large quantities. So the journey started in finance, and before I left PwC, I actually met with my co-founders. We were working on the impact of the financial crisis back in 2008. PwC actually had a unit that worked, looked at the potential impacts to the financial sectors in the wake of the financial crisis. And two of my co-founders now, Andrew Nevin and Manre Tang, and myself used to work together. And what we saw there is a crisis of sorts, where basically what happening in the financial sectors has spilled over to the main economy. So people suddenly found that it's very difficult for them to obtain loan from the bank or actually, you know, even find jobs. So what happening in the financialization of the world has, you know, what they call Wall Street has spillover impact on the Main Street. However, what we then look at the agriculture sector, to my mind, it's a different kind of crisis. The crisis where farmers who are responsible for producing and feeding the world is actually not well treated, especially those smallholder farmers. For countries like Vietnam, where it transformed itself from a net food importer to a food exporter, farmers are still relatively poor compared to other segments in societies. So how we can actually use technology to be able to not only help Africa to grow more food, but actually help farmers who are responsible for growing food have better lives. That is what we're trying to do with Bincarbon.
And give us a sense of, you know, what the landscape is within the agricultural sector in Vietnam, for instance. Is it controlled by a mighty few? What's the role of the small-scale farmer in that ecosystem?
Right. So in this sense, Africa and Vietnam has a lot of similarities, not just because of the climate. You know, one of the way, the reason why we started GrowMoreX, the company before Bincarbon, was because of the similar natural conditions that Vietnam shares with Africa or some parts of Africa. And then you ask the question, why would, you know, some places that have similar agroecological conditions being a net exporter and the other place being the net importer with the similar conditions. The structure of the agriculture sector is also similar. There's a lot of smallholder farmers in Vietnam. Typically, it's a country where it's 100 million people living in 300,000 square kilometers. So roughly a third of South Africa. So where you are based in South Africa,
yes.
Vietnam is about a third. But Vietnam have doubled the population. So land in Vietnam is extremely scarce. So for the 70% of the population who are engaged in agriculture in Vietnam, most of them are smallholder farmers. Now, the actual farming is done by smallholder farmers. The processing is, however, done by larger companies. A lot of them actually just private companies, but some of them are also state-owned companies, which is has very large size. The trading of these commodities are done between both larger private sector companies, but also state-owned companies as well. For example, the exporter of rice in Vietnam is mostly done through Vinafood 1, Vinafood 2, which are state-owned, and they control most of the export of rice, especially when it comes to government-to-government transactions. So it's a very, let's say, quite vibrant sector where you have lots and lots, millions and millions of smallholder farmers, you have lots and lots of processing companies. But when it comes to actual trading, especially when trading over cross-border trading, is done to a limited number of larger companies.
So your decades of experience in consulting, in deal making, in strategy at a consulting level might play in here. But what's your framework for looking for places on the continent where you can transfer the sort of insight you've gathered in a place like Vietnam? Like, where do you start? A continent is so vast. There are at least a dozen or more countries that sort of mirror the similar fundamentals that Vietnam might represent in terms of climate, perhaps, in terms of perhaps the nature of the existing infrastructure within agriculture. What's your approach to let's start over there in Africa?
My journey in agriculture in Africa started 7 years ago. And it started on the basis where Africa as a continent import a lot of food, and where, you know, most of the importation is actually taking place in West Africa, especially Nigeria. So we decided to focus on West Africa, on Nigeria, and on some of the commodities like rice, cassava, and so on, where we can readily bring the proven know-how from Vietnam, combine that with the latest agriculture technologies like drones, like satellite, to be able to make impact quickly. We were totally market driven. This is what the population actually wants. They want to be able to be self-sufficient in some of the staple foods. And that was how we got involved in actually the farming of rice and other type of commodities in West Africa. Now, moving on to Binkabi, where it is a technology using blockchain to transform the agriculture value chain and the trading and financing of agricultural commodities. So where we start is where we see that we can immediately have impact. So that would be West Africa, especially Nigeria. And then we look elsewhere on the continent where we can actually make significant impact. Then we have to look at larger markets like South Africa. So Nigeria and South Africa actually our two main markets right now in Africa when it comes to Binkabi.
So your strategy involves partnering or at least servicing the likes of EcoBank, Unity Bank. You know, there's quite an impressive list of incumbents that you provide services to. Is there not a tension between the sort of democratization potential of the technologies you'd like to introduce and the sort of existing interests controlled by incumbents that have traditionally not been very good at democratization and sharing and really just delivering on inclusiveness?
Right now, we're actually not providing service to them. So we are a platform developer, but also operator. So we are like Alibaba or Amazon or Uber. So we develop the technology, but we also operate the platform. So we're actually not selling any kind of technology or software to these companies
right.
that you just mentioned. That's why we need to have a much longer view in terms of how we cultivate these partnerships. And the partnerships are based on the principle of, you know, being complementary when it comes to bringing value to the supply chain. So as an example, the partnerships announced in Nigeria between AFEX, Winkabi, and the bank called Sterling Bank is where we each bring something to the table. So we basically enable what we call Uber for grain, which is trading of commodities of grains within Nigeria. So what we want is in this system where users of our platform, in order for the platform to be secure with the trading, we would like to get the sellers to be able to deposit their commodities at one of the warehouses provided by AFEX. Now AFEX also provide, because they have got the license to, the ability to create warehouse receipt out of these commodities. And then on the buyer side, what we ask them to do is they need to deposit money with Sterling Bank. And by connecting with both AFEX and Sterling, we are able to get the transactions to be issued and traded on the blockchain. So blockchain acts, and our technology acts as a connectivity layer between different actors in the supply chains to be able to enable secure trading. So ultimately, the seller get his money and the buyer get his commodities. That's the ultimate outcome. And this come from because of the huge disconnect in the supply chain of agricultural commodities, but also generally in commodities. And because of this disconnect, the assets in the supply chain, like you have situation where warehouses are laying empty whilst the crops are rotting in the fields or in the marketplace.
Or bananas are being
nowhere.
Or bananas exactly. are being dumped into the ocean because
exactly.
they don't have a market.
Yeah, they don't have the market, or simply they don't have somewhere to store.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of, if you are in Nigeria, you go to these market places and you see baskets of orange tomatoes being left rotten in the market, because if the farmers cannot sell them during the day, at the end of the day, they actually just leave them there because it's much more expensive for them to carry it back to their house, their home, because of the lack of storage facilities. So this is quite an irony in Africa, where you have harvest, you know, post-harvest loss can be as high as 50%, but whilst a lot of the storage facilities actually laying idle. There are many, many banks operating on the Kent continent, but there's also a lot of unbanked people. So how do you actually connect these otherwise fragmented actors in the supply chain in a way that will create value for everyone? So that is why people can get over the issue of being protective or being, you know, secretive about what they do, because ultimately it's also creating values for themselves, for their shareholders.
What do you say to cynics, perhaps even conspiracy theorists, who say this is all engineered complexity, this is all designed to be this way? And one might imagine that an organization like you might experience a pushback in attempts to sort of bring efficiencies where there were none.
Yeah, I think we have to separate between the reason why things are the way they are in Africa and the reality. We are mostly concerned with the reality.
Gotcha.
We are not so much concerned with why Africa is the way it is. I think there's a lot of people and organization are concerned with that. The reality today that we see is that farmers who are responsible to feed the countries, feed the nations, are not able to be able to feed themselves or send their kids to schools or be able to wait until better prices to sell such that they can actually gain more from their production. So what we are creating is optionalities for them, so they can either sell to a larger market and hopefully get better price, or they can actually wait until better price to sell, and in the meantime are able to access financing based on collateral, which is their commodities, so that they can still send their kids to school when waiting for better price to sell. So I think so far the pushback has been fairly minimal. We did actually talk to some of the large organizations in your country, in South Africa, and they said, okay, now we are working with you on this. So are we trying to, you know, accidentally put ourselves in the foot? I mean, it may be the case.
I'll bet you Nestle was one of the people you spoke to.
No,
you don't have to.
Actually, they are not.
Oh, okay. Not. Okay, I'm surprised. Yeah, yeah. I am genuinely surprised.
But yeah, they are not. But I think these are questions that people ask. Like, okay, I've been doing pretty well, so why do I need to change? And if I'm supporting you, am I actually, you know, making myself worse off?
Yeah, am I disrupting my own business model?
Exactly. But here, if you're looking at, let's say, in your kind of media sector, what happened to newspapers and the internet, you know, obviously when the internet comes, you know, the fact that you and I are able to be able to talk like this over the internet, you know, it takes 13-hour flight to South Africa from London, but we are able to instantly connect and talk on a broad range of topics like this. It's because of the power of the internet.
Yeah.
Now, blockchain is considered to be not the internet of information that what we've seen so far, but the internet of value, or in the internet of money.
Yeah.
So here we are trying to use blockchain to transfer value around, whether that is the commodity themselves or the payment for them. Blockchain, we found, is a way to, is a really suitable technology for that. And the other thing is also an opportunity for places like Africa, where there's lack of financial infrastructure, to be able to bypass or even leapfrog the first world, so to speak, when it comes to financial infrastructure by actually adopting this new technology.
So let's talk about what I perceive as the end game, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, the idea that on top of everything you've discussed, a sort of tokenization regimen that allows anybody sitting across, you know, the world, in Vietnam perhaps, or in the global north somewhere, to basically participate in an active agricultural market because you've created digital assets that enables that. Is that part of the plan?
Exactly right. So we would like to, like the word that you used before, democratize access to agricultural commodities market. So let's say right now, you know, farmers are struggling to sell when it comes to actually exporting. Only a few big companies are responsible for exporting. So with creation of assets that representing these commodities, we are and they are able to be traded 24/7. They are be traded in any kind of quantity, however small it is. We basically bring down the barrier to entries so that investors around the world are able to gain exposure to commodities, to, you know, to help their balance their portfolios, but also at the same time helping poorer farmers in these countries. So that is the power of the internet and the blockchain technology when it's combined. So allowing people everywhere, including in the country and elsewhere in the world, to be able to access that market.
Do you see this extending to the democratization of investments themselves? Because as things stand, only, you know, a privileged few can actually trade in commodities. And I'm speaking now in terms of the secondary markets, right?
Sure, that's right. So let's say in South Africa you have SAFEX, which is part of Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Now, to be able to trade on SAFEX, you have to trade to brokers.
Yeah.
In order to be a broker, or, you know, having a seat on SAFEX, you need to have certain kind of capital requirements or actually have paid in the past for a seat. It's the same everywhere. If you want to be a member of CME in the US or the Ethiopia Commodity Exchange in Ethiopia, or you know, the Dalian Exchange in China, you basically have to buy a seat. So therefore, it instantly excludes a lot of the segments of the society who are not able to get access to these markets. So when you actually trade, you're actually not trading directly on the market, but you're trading to brokers.
Yeah.
So what we are enabling is, ultimately, we would like to be people to be able to trade anywhere in the world with whatever small quantity they want. So, you know, you can get exposure to commodities market with $50, $100. This is the power of the technology. I mean, in our system, we denominate one token of rice to be 1 tons, and then we have 3 decimal places. So each decimal place representing 1 kilogram of rice. So in theory, people can get exposure to 1 kilogram of rice. Not that everyone would do that, but that is the power of the technology. You can actually bring down the barriers to entry.
So I'm going to ask you to explain in practical terms how someone listening to us today from anywhere in the world can get involved right now. But before we do that, a lot of the ideals that have so far characterized efforts within the space of distributed ledger technologies have been somewhat counterculture to the mainstream. How did you and your team figure out how best to structure this business in the knowledge that you would need to engage without compromising what clearly sounds like the values you have to make a societal impact?
The place to start there would be, okay, what kind of problems that you are trying to solve? What kind of problems that we are able to solve within the capabilities of the technology, of our experience, of our, you know, resources? And as I said before, the blockchain technologies lend itself to decentralization, but is places like Africa is ready for decentralization? Let's say ultimately you need to be commercially sustainable. You be able to, in order to make impact, you need to be around in 5-10 years. How can you actually find a business model that ultimately deliver values to your target customers, which is in this case the farmers, the small medium companies, the partners that you work with? How you can actually bring solutions to the market to create impact and create quickly? So that's why we are not so much idealistic in terms of what is the potential of this technology, you know, in terms of being anarchists, being decentralization, but actually what the problems that it can actually solve, given our experience and our understanding and our network in Africa, but also in other emerging markets. So we basically look for a partnership type of arrangements where we bring the technology, we operate the platform, but we will be working with partners like commodity exchanges and banks to be able to bring an end-to-end solution to the market. So we are not trying to, trying to eat in the existing cake. We're trying to create a new cake, or we're trying to make the existing cake bigger and therefore share a part of it by creating that extra value that everyone can benefit from.
And so how much pressure are you under in the short term to sort of monetize on the way to that future,
exactly,
or even achieve profitability? Well, what are things looking like right now?
So we are just started in Nigeria. In Nigeria we started what we call Uber for Grain, which is basically a marketplace to connect buyers and sellers, but also service providers like, you know, warehouse, storage, you know, banks. We also, to our partners, are able to offer lending on the back of commodities warehouse receipt. So one of the banks The Sterling Bank has committed to lend at least $30 million to our platform. So we are exploring other markets like South Africa, like Vietnam. We already started in Vietnam. And even Eastern European markets like Ukraine, where, you know, it's also emerging markets. It's also have a very big agriculture sector, but also a lot of issues. So because of the way that we chose in terms of our business model, not being a vendor of technology or software, meaning that we are, you know, not cash flow positive right now. So actually we are in a very deep investment phase right now. We have very, very little revenue, but we have a lot of costs. So there's a lot of pressure in terms of how you can actually get to profitability quickly to be able to sustain ourselves. But then we also need to balance that against the need to grow, because like any technology companies, if you are making, let's say, profit too soon, you're probably not growing fast enough. So to balance that is really difficult.
And so what's home base for Binkabi? Does that matter in the context of what I imagine might be very high touch sort of relationship building that you need to do? How important is where you call home base, where people perceive you're from? I don't know if you've encountered those sort of dynamics as you've done business on the continent, perhaps even in Vietnam. Does it matter to people or the people you're looking to partner with?
Actually, not that important. I mean, people, when they heard that, okay, we actually located the majority of our management team is based in London. We got our co-founders and, you know, a couple of people in Lagos, Nigeria. And then our development team is based in Vietnam. People say, hey, so that's quite interesting. But ultimately, it's about the DNA that we have in terms of solving issue in the agriculture value chain in emerging markets. So that is our base. That is our home. Because of our kind of confluence of experience in terms of understanding how financial sector works, understanding how commodities work, but also have deep first-hand experience of growing up, but also working in these emerging markets. That is our home. We don't consider geographical to be a limit to be as important. Ultimately, it's about solving what problems in what markets.
So have you guys raised? Have you raised a pre-seed, a seed? Where are you at in terms of that? And just give me a sense of, you know, what sort of pressure you're under to convert.
Yes. So far we are just about to close a seed round this month, where we're raising up to $2 million. To basically help us to launch in a couple of markets and to expand in the markets that we are in. And that process is still ongoing. So, of course, we are under pressure. But at the same time, it's very exciting. And because of our setup, because of our, I guess, when it comes to geographical location, I think because of the way we set up with our team based in different locations, but also have ability to tap in to sort of the high-tech industry in Vietnam and in Asia, where the cost is a lot lower compared to, let's say, Europe or the US. That give us an advantage in terms of cost, so we can be very, very agile, very nimble and flexible when it comes to actual bringing our solutions to the market. So we don't have very, very high fixed costs, and our costs are almost entirely based on how fast we can grow.
I'm interested in knowing, like, some of the most common misconceptions or perhaps oversimplifications you encounter whenever you have to pitch the business opportunity that is the African continent, the markets you've mentioned. Maybe the most damaging or dangerous misconceptions or oversimplifications made about the financial opportunity you're trying to address?
Yeah, we do a lot of pitching, some of them to kind of VC investors. So basically to kind of get an idea or get to grips with the size of the opportunities that we are trying to address or to work in, you basically need to understand three things. One is commodities. So you need to be able to understand, you know, how agriculture commodities work and what are the challenges that the supply chain in those markets are facing at the moment. Because it's not the same way as, you know, other commodities or even other kind of assets. So the first thing is commodities. The second thing you have to understand is finance. So how finance actually works, especially in the markets that are not very well developed. And the third thing you have to understand is, you know, the blockchain technology itself, which is still a nascent technology. You know, it's still very, very early days. The performance, the scalability is not that high. There's still a lot of mixing up between blockchain and cryptocurrencies. So, you know, you need people to at least understand two out of those three things. And it has been a challenge to find those type of people. So that, I think that is the often, maybe not misconceptions, but actually challenges to work in the market or the product or the solutions that we are providing, which is basically helping farmers and SMEs and actors in agriculture value chains in emerging markets to be able to be more efficient and creating more value by getting better access to market, better access to financing. So those are the challenges when it comes to actually pitching the opportunities to other people. But the market is absolutely huge, because when you talk about even agriculture trading between country, it's over about $1.5 trillion in terms of international trading, but when it comes to the actual domestic trading, it will be many times over that. So here we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars in terms of market opportunities, but in order to tackle that, you need to understand those three main elements.
What's the most challenging question you fielded from a venture capitalist about your business? Perhaps a question that got you thinking about your business in a different way. And I want a good question, not one of the dumb ones, you know, like a really good question that got you thinking and maybe even changed how you look at your own business.
To be fair, so far we haven't seen a lot of those because of the challenges that I just told you in terms of a very, very good questions.
I'm smiling because I'm like, oh yeah, that's shot fired. I'm sure the investors in London go, oh, I know.
The sort of questions that we get from, let's say, a VC, let's say outside type of investors, actually like standard questions like, oh, who are your competitors? Why are people using your services? Oh, are you sort of disrupting incumbent players? So more kind of theoretical textbook kind of questions.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, there's a process that people have to go through when they decide to make investments. Most of our investors are actually strategic investors, and they are actually partners with us in some shape or forms. And we're actually not having that many kind of typical VC. So, you know, some VC are interested in, for example, marketplaces. They invest in a lot of marketplaces. So they found the solution that we bring kind of fit into that criteria that they are looking for. But then they would be struggling to understand, first of all, commodities or, you know, emerging markets.
Yeah.
So, you know, we haven't found a lot of, let's say, a good question,
yeah,
coming from, let's say, the standard VCs. So most of our investors are actually strategic partners that we have.
And then in Vietnam, are you getting any interest, any sort of investment interest, partnership interest from Asia?
We haven't quite explored that route.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
Well, okay. So, and this is perhaps true elsewhere as well. I mean, if we, again, it's coming back to, okay, Vietnam, I understand agriculture commodities. Vietnam might understand technology because some of them, Vietnam is fast becoming a very good sort of blockchain development location. But Vietnam might not understand Africa.
Yeah. Right?
Vietnam thinks that Africa is very remote, very risky, it's war-torn, it's famine. These are kind of misconceptions that a lot of people outside of Africa actually have. And I would say the same for other countries in Asia, like China or other countries in Southeast Asia. That is how, quite a large section of society or economy still think Africa is a very, very remote and risky and, poor place.
To be fair, when my wife and I told some of our friends and family that we were visiting Vietnam, a lot of people were like, why?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they think Vietnam is still in during the war.
They thought we might be going to go, feed some people and build some schools or something. We were like, No, we're on holiday. We're definitely on holiday.
So that's why we have not specifically targeted in Vietnam. So when we do get tractions from the industry collaboration that we are debuting, then I think that's the right place to target. Also in other places in Asia, our strength is really to connect Asia and Africa, and I think there are a lot of potentials in Asia.
So,
when it comes to investment.
So my final question to you then is, since you haven't been getting any good questions, what question do you wish you would receive more often? And give us the answer to that question.
Actually, that's a good question.
Well, thank you.
So I'm just trying to craft the answers to that.
Yeah.
It's kind of having two layers. So, a lot of people will ask, okay, so you are going to give blockchain technology to the poor farmers of Africa, right? How are you going to do that, right?
Yeah.
So that could be a fairly standard sort of question. So fairly shallow kind of question.
Yeah.
The moment you mentioned that you are trying to improve, I try to avoid the word disrupt, but trying to create value out of the agriculture supply chain in Africa, then a lot of people will ask, so how do you actually get farmers onto the platform? So that is a fairly standard sort of question when we mention that we are doing things in this space. But I guess if the people who ask the question has a very deep understanding of the challenges that Africa has, right? Especially when it comes to agriculture productions, then the sort of answer that they'll be looking for, which we wish they would be satisfied when we give them, is that, yeah, actually, to be very, very practical, we don't think that we necessarily go directly to the farmers in the first place. We think because of the fact that a lot of farmers in Africa are smallholder farmers, even if we are able to bring them to the platform, they actually won't have much to sell. And it's very difficult for them to actually bring their crops to accredited warehouse that that our partners has. So we're actually targeting the people who aggregate the commodities from them. We are helping them to be able to bring those commodities to the warehouse, being able to get paid, being able to get financing from the banks so that they can actually buy from the farmers, being able to make more money so that they can pay more for farmers. So we're trying to help those small guys as well. But in the future, what we are planning to do, and we already started talking, is that we also recognize the transformation role of the mobile phone and mobile money. Right. So we in our vision, we're planning to work with mobile operators to actually enable the payment of the commodities using mobile money, but tokenize mobile money to our platform so that when farmers actually delivered that one or two tons of rice to the aggregators. Aggregator accepted the goods, then the payment will automatically get you know, paid directly to the wallet, mobile wallet of the farmers. And that is how we can see how we can able to bring a lot of farmers to the platform, not directly by them actually having to press certain button, but actually for them to be able to receive their payment very, very conveniently.
Wow.
And that would help adoption.
So I'll tell you this. My mom and dad are farmers, smallholder farmers in Zimbabwe. And my acid test, whenever I speak to people in your space, is would my parents be impacted by this? Would they use the service? Would it change their lives? Would it make it easier? Would it improve the very hard work? Would it improve, and I'm speaking about something that just happened just this week, would it improve their ability to bring in 5 tons of onion from rural Matabeleland into Zimbabwe's second city, Bulawayo? Would it help with that? And I'm very happy to say the question you asked and the question you answered at the end there gives me some confidence that you have applied your mind sufficiently to what would actually move the needle for people like them.
To move the people like them is not about teaching them how cool the blockchain technology
is. No, because that's not going to work.
Actually,
that's not going to work for my
70-year-old
parents.
You know, giving them more money in their wallet. That's how.
Yeah.
If people suddenly say, okay, I don't really care how the platform works or how this, you know, I have to push certain button on your apps. I mean, the aggregators who are, let's say, a bit more tech savvy, who driving around in their trucks can know that, can go through that. But if, you know, they receive a beep beep on their phone and they see, oh, you know, in my bank account, in my mobile wallet, I actually have more money, then everyone would understand that signal.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I certainly wish you well. Binkabi sounds like one to watch. I know you're under pressure. All startup founders are. I'm fairly encouraged by the buzz about your business that I've heard in the marketplace so far. And yeah, I can only hope that you guys survive this sort of nascent period and not end up becoming victims of the very change that you're trying to bring through. I suppose one just hopes that companies like you, thinkers like you, teams like yours make it through to, you know, become part of the fabric of what we, you know, 10 years from now think, oh my word, you guys were a startup at some point.
Well, thank you. And in that sense, you know, as somebody who come from Asia, from Vietnam, who, you know, as a country, we live through wars, a lot of human conflicts. We also taught ourselves to be survivors.
Yeah.
And how to find the war with a very little means.
Yeah.
Ultimately, yes, as I said, we are international team as well. So myself come from Vietnam, but we also have, you know, one child policy co-founder from China. And another co-founder, Andrew, is actually from Canada, but have lived in China for 10 years. So we are ultimately a multicultural team who all sort of experience or live, you know, experience firsthand or actually have lived and grown up in emerging markets. So we can actually combine some of the good things that, you know, where we come from, but also, you know, good things that come from elsewhere. But ultimately, it's about the deep understanding about the conditions and the challenges in Africa.
As good a place as any to put it down. Thank you so much for being on the show, Kwanle of Binkabi. Thank you so much for being on the African Tech Roundup.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Adil. Bye-bye.